Thank you, Jim. I never could remember names till I took that Dale Carmichael course. Want to thank Carol for a beautiful talk. And I sympathize with the Al-Anon speakers who had to follow Alice. Glad to see Charlie here, down on the incurable road, that's where he belongs. And if none of you have ever seen Charlie T, you missed something. I was looking for Joe, MCQ, and I saw George Gibbs walk in, and I'm always glad to see them here because it adds color to our midst. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Franklin Williams. I, by the grace of God, the fellowship with men and women like you, and because this program does work, it hadn't been necessary for me to take a drink today. The chairman said he didn't know what to expect. I told him a lot of nice things to say about me, but he didn't say them. And that reminds me of a story, my chairman. And any similarity between my chairman and this story is strictly coincidental. But this being Indian territory, some officials from Washington, from the Indian Affairs, visited in this area a few months ago. And they went to see the chief of one of the tribes. And they told him, says, now right out in front here, says, we're going to build a tremendous university for your Indian people. And the chief says, Hoya. So he says, right across from it, we're going to build a public school for your Indian children. The chief says, Hoya. And says, right down the road, we're going to build you an Olympic-sized swimming pool. The chief said, Hoya. So he went on and told him several other things that they were going to do, and the chief replied to each one, Hoya. So then just as the people started to leave, they turned around and said, Chief, we understand you have a beautiful herd of Angus bulls. And while we are here, we'd like to go out in the pasture and inspect your herd. And the chief says, okay, but don't step in the Hoya. I'm what the book refers to as a real alcoholic. And the book refers to the real alcoholic in a number of instances. And I think there's a reason for it. I won't go into that. I'll only say that I am a real alcoholic. And I'm an arrested alcoholic. In fact, I have been arrested many times. And I hear some people say they were arrested 100 times, 50 times, 70 times, so on. I never did keep up with how many times I was arrested. And I wish I had. But I didn't know it was going to be a thing of social prestige when I... when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Who knows, Alcoholics Anonymous may come up with a pension plan. And I'd miss out on some of my benefits. I belong to the Quonset group in Memphis, Tennessee. And I also attend the Olive Branch group in Olive Branch, Mississippi. Now both groups, and you'd never guess why, but both groups are now studying the big book. And we are trying to learn what the directions are. And we think that if a new person comes into either one of these groups, and these are not the only groups in my area that study the big book, but we think if a new person comes into these groups and learns the instructions, he won't know about all of these other instructions. And he won't know any better than to believe that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous comes from a textbook called Alcoholics Anonymous. So a big part of my sermon today is going to be devoted to a textbook called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not going to interpret this book for you because it's too beautifully interpreted as it is. For 9 months, especially after I came in, I interpreted the book and I stayed drunk. And only after I began to follow directions did I have any success in this program. So that's what I'm going to talk largely about. In fact, the text of my sermon this morning is going to be Keep It Simple and Follow Directions. The original manuscript of our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, mentioned several times in there, now you are ready to follow directions. And I hope I am ready at this time to follow directions. Now, in order to talk about the simplicity of this program, Keeping It Simple and Following Directions, I'm going to have to bring in my sponsor. And I do this for a number of reasons. I do it, one, to let you know that I did have and have a sponsor. And I had a tough sponsor, and I still have a tough sponsor. And I talked some about this not long ago at a place, and some people came up afterwards and said, where do you find a sponsor like that? I said, well, there are only a few of them left. But my reason for talking about it is that hopefully, if I talk about it enough, hopefully and prayerfully, that I will become the type sponsor that my sponsor was and my present sponsor is to me. Excuse me. And hopefully and prayerfully that you will be motivated enough to try to become that type of sponsor. Because I think if there's a weakness in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my area, it's in sponsorship. And I have some definite ideas about what a good sponsor is. I think a good sponsor is to explain the directions to you, to explain the steps, and not just tell you how to do it, but to put their arms around you and walk with you and do this thing together. I was so messed up mentally when I came in that I couldn't read a line and retain it. And had it not been for a tough sponsor like I had, I don't think I would have ever gotten sober. And God knew that because I got one. And I didn't do like the book, our literature says, a pamphlet on sponsorship. Just pick out someone to type with a type of sobriety that you like and ask him to be your sponsor. I didn't like any of them. And I didn't think any of them were sober if they wasn't drinking their own pills or something. Because I didn't see how a person could stay sober. And my sponsor said he'd been sober 12 years. And I didn't tell him, but I thought he was a damn liar. And if he wasn't drinking, he was bound to be on some of them happy pills. So that's what I think a sponsor is supposed to do, and I'll talk a good deal about it. I can call my little sponsor's name now because he's gone on to the big meeting, David Gates. In fact, I had three to begin with that they appointed. They sublet me when I came in. And they drew straws, and three of them lost. And I fired them all, but little old David said, I'm not enjoying this any more than you are. But won't anybody else fool with you, and I'm going to take you on a trial basis. And that's what he did. And he was a poor little ignorant, illiterate person. I read to him for 5 years out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I knew he could read. He knew where everything was. He could tell me the page and he could point to it in there, but he couldn't read. And I wanted some of that scratch he had in his pocket. And he was the only one that'd take up the time with me. And I thought, well, the poor little fellow is trying to stay sober. And an intelligent person like me should try to read to him and try to explain this thing to him because he wasn't capable of understanding it, because he'd asked me over and over to reread it. And and he is always telling me, you must do this, you must do that. And Marin Hill, another one that's gone on to the big meeting, he is always telling me, you must do this, you must do that. And we had a cat in our group named Allen. I won't call his last name. He's gone on somewhere. And he used to tell me that the reason I couldn't drink is because my capillaries was out of balance. And I didn't have to do all these damn things that Marin and David is telling me to do. That all I had to do was go to a medical doctor and get my capillaries straightened out, and I could drink socially, whatever that is. So I'd tell David, I'd say, Alan says something wrong with my capillaries. And David had a pat answer. I could ask him what time it was, and he'd say, don't drink, go to meet and read a big book. And so I asked him about this. He said, what does the big book say about it? And I had learned that I had to go to the big book. I tell David I'd been to the big book. And I said, David, the big book don't say nothing about it. He said, it must not be important. So then he said, let me tell you this. He said, you always talking about there's no must. He said, the word must is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous 74 times. And so it must be important. But I'll tell you this. If you want to stay sober, you must become willing to stop drinking. And said, that's one must for you. And said, it has been our experience and our observation that alcohol never causes anybody into trouble till they swallow some of it. And said, you must not swallow any of it. And said, it has also been our experience that rarely have we seen a person stay sober who continues to drink. And I said, David, this makes sense. Why hadn't you told me this before? And so then I said, David, see, I came to this program saying I was an agnostic. I didn't know what an agnostic was, but it sounded good. And I said, David, this is fine for you religious people, but you know I'm an agnostic. He said, that don't make a damn. Say, all you got to do is make up your mind whether you want to be a sober agnostic or a drunk agnostic. And I said, David, I ain't got no faith. He said, I know you hadn't. And says, you won't have any faith until you apply these steps to your program. And by the time that you get on through the ninth step, you will have had some experiences. And you will know that these things didn't happen as a result of me or of you. And as the promise, the last promise on page 84 says, or the last of those promises, that suddenly you will realize that God is doing for you what you could not do for yourself. Now, what next? See, the reason I'm bringing this in is not only to show you the type of sponsor that I think that I need to be, but also to let you know that I had a wall built up that I wouldn't let anybody through. And I had to have all these excuses and all these alibis and all broken down, and to realize that these people saw me just as I was, because I was putting up a front to them of the way I wanted them to see me, and I knew it was different from what I was, and I was trying to keep them from seeing me. But when David broke down all of these things, and I say when I got caught, well, then I realized that other people saw me as I was, and I wasn't fooling anybody. And I said, David, I don't know what God's will is. You always talk about God's will, and the steps say something about God's will. He said, no, I don't guess you do, but says you know what it ain't. And said, you just do that. And by doing that, you'll be doing God's will. I said, David, you fellows, see, I was unemployed, unemployable, and he was always telling me to read that big book. And I said, David, you know I don't have any money. I was living in a little garage apartment as gratis a friend. I was eating at the AA club when they'd have these eating meetings, and I'd make the noon meetings where they'd have some sandwiches, and that's really where I was eating. Now, I said, David, you know I don't have money enough to buy a big book. I can't read it. And he said, you SB, I believe you've got to talk to a drunk at the level of his understanding. And David talked to me at the level of my understanding. He spoke in my native tongue, vulgarity. And he said, you SB, you, said, I'll tell you what you do. You go steal a big book. Says, you know how to steal. And before you get too damn honest, we got a step in this program when you get on to it that you can make amends for stealing that big book. And I said, David, this thing's all right for you people. You people are married. Now, David wasn't. He never was married. You people are married. You got nice wheels. You got nice threads. You got that scratch in your pocket and that lettuce in your pocket. You can stay sober. But what about a fella like me? I don't have any threads. I don't have any wheels. I don't have any wife. And I don't have any job. He said, turn to page 98. And he pointed there and he said, now read this to me. And on that page it says, wife or no wife, job or no job, our sobriety is not dependent on others. And then a little further down it says, but it is dependent on our willingness to trust God and to clean house. He said, now turn over to the next page, 99, and the top of page 100 and read that to me. And I read that to him, and it said the same thing. I said, David, that says the same thing. He said, I know it does. Said, Bill figured some cat like you is going to come along. And you'd miss it on page 98. And maybe the second, third time around, you'd see it. And said, it might be easier for you to remember pages 98, 99, and 100 than just remember one page. So that's the type of profundity I got. Profundity never got me sober. And I don't think profundity gets any of us sober. I think it's little simple things. Like, don't drink. I know David would take me to meetings every night. And I don't say do this with a person too long. Because after a while he said, you got to the liquor store, now you get to the meeting. I don't have any wheels. He said, we find walking helps. Said, you don't have anything else to do. So he'd take me out to these meetings, and the first meeting that he went to where he didn't speak, I know he took me to a bunch of them and he was speaking. I said, David, don't anybody else talk? He said, nobody you need to hear. So he took me out to a group one night, and he said, now this is going to be a different type meeting. Said, this is going to be a closed meeting. But I didn't know what a closed meeting was, but I sure as hell wasn't going to ask David. And I said, David, are you going to speak? He said, no, that's a closed meeting. Said, they're going to call on everybody. I said, you going to call on me? He said, yeah. Well, I beamed, because I wanted to get up and tell him what's wrong with this folks. He said, now let me give you some directions before you go out there. He believed in action. Reading, he had to be doing all that reading. He said, when we go out there and they get around to you and when they call on you, well, you get on your feet. He believed in getting on your feet and on your knees. That's two things he believed in. He said, you get on your feet and you say, you're an alcoholic and your name is Franklin Williams and you're a member of the Quonset group and you sit your ass down. He said, you done told them people all you know. I said, David, I thought, oh, no, you done made a mistake. Said, don't think. Said, that's the worst thing in the world. A new member of Alcoholics Anonymous can do is think. Says, you're not to think for a year. And at the end of a year, if you're capable of thinking, we'll let you know. And said, if you go home tonight and wake up during the night and think you got to go to the bathroom, call me first. Said, you'll do the wrong thing. And I said, well, David, in every one of these club rooms we've got, they got these signs around. Think. He said, that's for us. Said, that ain't for you. Said, don't you attempt it. So this is the type of profundity that I got. As I said, I don't think profundity ever got any of us sober. And anything I say up here about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to try to back it up from a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, where it gives us the direction. And I want you to check on me. In fact, if you get a sponsor that tells you to do something, I want you to check on him and check him out in the big book. And if what he's not telling you, you get you another sponsor, because that sponsor can kill you. And another thing, get you a sponsor that's worth the steps. How in the devil is a man going to tell, a woman going to tell me how to work the four steps if they hadn't worked it? We got some old fella at home that says, you can't no more teach what you ain't learned, and you can come back from where you ain't been. And I believe in getting that type of a sponsor, and I believe in being that type of sponsor. So the big book backs me up as far as I'm concerned in what I say about profundity not getting a soap. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that the spirit of AA will get me sober, and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous will keep me sober. Now, I don't say this, but this is my opinion, and I got a lot of opinions. And I think you spell that spirit L-O-V-E. I think the people in the concert group in Memphis, Tennessee, love this old drunk sober. And I think I was able to stay without drinking for a number of months, just on the spirit, the enthusiasm in that group. And I think that length of time will vary with each and every one of us, depending on how sick we are. I was pretty sick. I wasn't capable of doing anything for a long time, and God gave me this period to get to where I could get my brain out of hock and think a little bit and do some things. But then a time comes when I've got to get up off of it and begin to do some things. So I really believe that this spirit or this enthusiasm is love. And I'm thoroughly convinced that anything that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me is true. And I am more and more trying to study those directions and trying to follow those directions. But because I think many of us settle for much too little in this program. There's a lot more to this program, in my opinion, than just not drinking. See, I had to have something during my drinking to take care of right now, right this minute. And I came to a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after I found out what the directions were and began to follow these directions, I have a program today whereby I can take care of right now. Not tomorrow, not Christmas, not New Year's, but right this minute. And see, while I was, before I came to this program, even if I was not drinking, I think this pain of sobriety to me was so great that I had to have something right then to take care of right now. And the only thing that I knew that would take care of right now was to reach and get that thing which for years had changed things, John Barleycorn. And then I reached a point where alcohol would no longer change things. I think I can sum up this whole program, this whole ball of wax, with six words. And with me, this is simplistic. I try to get things down the way I can understand it. And I use these six words every day because it does simplify it for me and it's easy for me to remember. And those six words are trust God, clean house, and help others. And I say everything I know came from this book. Where'd this come from? It's all through the book. In the 11th chapter of Vision to You, the last number of sentences and words is as beautiful a series of words as I ever heard. It says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of the past. Give freely of what you have found. And join us, and surely you will meet some of us as you tread your road to happy destiny. So that's where I got part of it. And then didn't Bill say, let us instill in the hearts and minds of every new person that they too can get well if they trust God and clean house. And then Bill also tell us that the surest immunity against not drinking is working with others. This works when all else fails. So trust God, clean house, and help others. I didn't know what the physical allergy is, what the mental obsession. I didn't know anything. And I only learned it by reading it and explaining it to David. And he had me to read what the mental obsession is. That we are possessed of an obsession. He had me to look up the word obsession. And I looked it up. See, he didn't do anything for me that I could do for myself. And I'm not comparing David with God, but I think that's the way God works. God is not going to do anything for me that I can do myself. But he'll grant me the willingness, and then he'll give me the strength and the courage to do this. So I looked up that word obsession, and it says an idea that overpowers any other idea that we might have. So I had an idea that overpowered any idea that I had, that someday, some way, I was going to find a way to defeat this thing. And that's what a mental obsession is to me. And I didn't lose that mental obsession till I came to you people. And it was sometime after I came to you people. Now, the book don't tell me this, but this is my opinion. I don't think my mental obsession has been removed. I think it has been replaced. I think I have an idea today that overpowers any other idea that I might have, that I want to stay sober more than I want to drink. So I think that is the thing that replaced that idea to drink. Also, I don't think, and the book don't tell me this, because it tells me in there to pray that my fears be removed, to pray that my shortcomings, catch defects be removed. I think what has happened with me, and that's all that I can share with you, is what has happened to me. I think with me, God has granted me the willingness to do something about my fears, my shortcomings, my character defects. And he's given me the strength and the courage to practice the opposite of these. For instance, fear. I've been able to get some faith and to practice faith. Instead of self-pity, I've been able to practice gratitude. And I think as long as I'm practicing these positive things, those negative things are out of the way. But when I stop, those negative things come back. Now, this is just my opinion. And I think this is what has happened with me. I'll only mention my last drunk. Well, I'll go on into this mental obsession. As I told you, I have to keep things simple. And I have to think back to when I was in college, and that was a devil of a long time ago. It wasn't last year. And I tell you that to let you know I'm educated. And Eloise says I'm educated way beyond my intelligence. But be that as it may, we were going out to freshman football, and we had an old boy on the team from Sullivan's Hollow, a real rough district of Mississippi. And he is about, every time I tell it, he gets bigger. But the way I remember it, he's about 6'3 or 6'4, weighed 230 or 240 or something like that. Had arms that came way down below his knees, and his wrists were way along up here. He had the biggest hands I ever saw. And he had old bushy red hair that stood out like barbed wire. And what Red McGinnis said was law. And I made the mistake one day in the grill of smarting off to Red McGinnis. And the next thing I knew, I was getting up off the floor. And every time I'd get up, Red McGinnis knocked me back down. Well, nobody had to pull me off of Red McGinnis. And they haven't had to do it in all these years since. Because I completely and unconditionally surrendered to Red McGinnis that day. Back in 1928 or 29. And I've never had a mental obsession to say anything smart to him since that time. But you know, it wasn't until I had a Red McGinnis surrender to alcohol that I had any success. Because alcohol would knock me down, I'd get back up, and it knocked me down again. But finally, I was able to have a Red McGinnis surrender. I tell new people that I work with, you got to have a Red McGinnis surrender. And their eyes turn wrong side. They don't know what I'm talking about. But I know what I'm talking about. And this has been very beneficial to me in my AA, because when I take my life and start running with it, I'll say, old buddy, you need to get on your knees and have a Red McGinnis surrender to God. And this simplicity to me has been very, very meaningful. Why did I come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? There are a number of things that I could give as reasons, but it really boils down to one. This is a suggested program, and a judge suggested that I come. He gave me an alternate plan. I could go to the penal farm. So I weighed the situation very carefully and decided I had more to offer you people than I did the people at the penal farm. So that's the real reason that I graced you with my presence. I haven't talked anything about drinking, and the book don't tell me how to drink or how not to drink, but it tells me how to live one day at a time. And I'll only mention my last drunk, let you know I'm not up here through mistake. In fact, I've never seen anybody get up behind one of these things through mistake. I suffered the same humiliation, the same guilt, the same remorse, same loneliness that you did. I started drinking at 16 and drank until I was 45. I drank 29 years. And I gave it everything that I had, especially during the last 10 years. And about the last 7 years, I was drinking purely and simply for oblivion. Something to take care of right now. And if I was, and I was many times, locked up in jail, the first thing I wanted when I got out of that jail was a drink. And that's the first thing I'd get. Why? Because the pain of sobriety was so great that I couldn't stand it. And I had to have something for right now, right now, right this minute. And I think all of us need something for right this minute. And thank God that the Bible says it came to pass and don't say it came to stay. And I found out that if I can just hang on long enough and pray for help, that the thing will pass. So I had been strapped down and had been seeing things, and my family had a meeting to which I wasn't invited. And my wife had two cousins that were doctors And one of them wanted to send me to Keeley, and one of them wanted to send me to a resort in Mississippi called Whitfield, insane asylum. So as soon as I was able to get up out of that bed and put on my clothes, I came to Memphis, Tennessee. And I came to Memphis to dodge a lunacy warrant. And shortly after I was there, I was able to get my wife back. Shortly after that, I got thrown back in jail. She got me out, right back in jail. And then she left, and she's the one that turned me in to you people. So I had been around the program for 9 months, going to just enough meetings to let certain people know that I was going to meetings. And I went to my wife and asked her, how sober did I have to get before you take me back? And she said a very nasty thing. She said, you'll never get sober enough for me to take you back. And said, if you were to die tonight, who would be your pallbearer? And that hurt. You know, the truth hurts for an alcoholic. And I didn't want to hear the truth. So I did the only thing that I knew to do, was to go out and get drunk at her. And I don't know how long I stayed drunk, and I don't know how much I drank, but it was just enough. And I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous just at the right time. Maybe the day before would have been too early. Maybe the day afterwards would have been too late. Like someone said up here, it takes what it takes. And it took all of this to bring me to my knees and to ask for help and to get here. So I had borrowed a car and stolen a piece of plastic hose. And I was going to take my life. And I went in this little garage apartment that they were letting me live in gratis. And David had given me a yellow legal pad to write my inventory on. So I don't know about you, but I just loved to cry when I was drinking. I could play this old hillbilly music and just cry gallons and gallons. And I could play Al Jolson's Sonny Boy and just cry up a storm. So I got to playing, and she had an old Victrola in there, and it'd play one record, you'd have to go over there and turn it back and wind it up again. And it'd nearly wind down, but I'd just cry a little slower when it... So I was writing that farewell note. Honey, you can have everything. I had it all on. I'm going on. And I got to thinking about my funeral and all the people that's going to be there. And I could see my wife looking down and saying, you poor dear, if I had only understood. And she had these two idiot brothers that caused me to be an alcoholic. And they had their arms around her, and they were telling us, you killed old Franklin. And then these two numbskull doctors, they said, if you'd have left Franklin alone, left him in Mississippi, he never would have died. And I'd cry some more. And I'd cried so much till the tears had dropped on the bottom of that yellow legal pad and the pen wouldn't write. So I drew an arrow up to the top and said, see next page. So I cried all I could and I went on out to the car and I started the engine. And then a peculiar thing happened. I got thirsty. And I remembered in that little garage apartment that I had a spider of wine there, and I wanted to polish that off. And then something else happened. I passed out. And I waked up, not come to, but I waked up the early morning, 1 or 1:30, I'm not sure, of October the 15th, 1956, with as clear a mind as I've ever had, up to then or up till now, I believe. And I think God grants us this. I think he grants us a moment of truth. At least he granted me a moment of truth. And I saw myself as I really was. And I fell to my knees, and for the first time in my adult life, I said a honest and sincere prayer. And I don't know what I said other than God help me. But evidently I said enough and stayed on my knees long enough to make a contract and to make a decision. And in my opinion, I took the first three steps of this program that early morning of October the 15th on my knees. I admitted there was no way that I could successfully handle alcohol. And I admitted there's no way that I could keep from drinking. Therefore, I was powerless over alcohol. And I admitted I'd done the things that I hadn't intended to do, and I'd left undone the things I did intend to do. So my life was unmanageable, and an unmanageable life is just that simple to me. Now, if my life was unmanageable, I needed a manager. And in step two, you told me about this manager. Now, if my life was unmanageable and I needed a manager, it made sense that if I got this manager, I need to turn my life and will over to him. So that's what you told me to do in step three. And I got up off of my knees and got into bed and slept soundly. Now, drunk that drinks wine like I did, don't do that. And around 6 or 6:30, I waked up. And I went to the kitchen. Now, this person has let me live there and asked if I might use a phone. And I called my little sponsor, David Gates. And I said, David, something's happened and I don't understand it. I want you to come over and talk to him. And he was there in a matter of a few minutes. I thought it was hours. But he sat down on the end of that bed and began to tell me things about himself. And I'm sure he had told me many of these before, but some of them I didn't remember. But the remarkable thing was that I began to tell David things about me that I had never told another human being. And David said, they're going to get some of your time. Now, in this case, when I refer to they, I'm talking about the men in blue down at the local Bastille. So in 2 days' time, they captured me. And David told me what to do. He said, you found a program here that if you will do these things that the directions tell you to do, your life will be set straight, and God is not going to put anything on you that you can't stand. So you just get on your knees every morning and as many times during the day as necessary and tell it, said, God, I don't know anything about you. Said, be honest. But I have some friends that seem to know a lot about you. And they've told me about you, and they've told me what you have done for them as a result of them following some directions. And that you're going to report to them every morning. And for him to tell you what to do or to direct you and to give you the strength and the courage to do it. And I began to do this. And I have continued to do it from that day, and some wonderful things have happened. They sent me to the Penal Farm, and that was good for me. And David told me, said, you make up your mind that while you're out there, you're going to school. And you're going to school to learn to live. You're going to have little tests every day, but your main exam is going to be when you hit the streets and get with these lions and tigers. And I went out there and tried to sober up every person in that joint. I tried to sober up the warden, and he didn't even have a drinking problem. But it was good for me because it kept me active. And I went to the warden and asked him if we might start a group. He said yes. So I asked him if I could call David. He knew David. Said yes. So David and some others came out and we started the group. And that group is still there. And that group really saved my life. And I'm grateful for it. Now I went along and did the other steps. I thought to the best of my ability. And I think it was to the best of my ability at that time. And I want to bring this out for several reasons. One reason is to let you know that a fellow can stay around this program for years and years and not drink and really not get anywhere. Somewhere between 9 and 10 years of not drinking, I began to get uncomfortable. And in every area of my life, Eloise knows a lot about it because things were real rough at home. And I want to say this about Al-Anon right now. This is one of the greatest experiences, one of the greatest honors that has ever been bestowed on me since I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as being able to take part and asked to take part in an Al-Anon convention. Nothing is meaningful to me unless I've experienced it. Marin and David, David didn't have a wife, as I said. Marin's wife was an alcoholic. And when I came in, a lot of people didn't know even as much as the people now know about Al-Anon. And they told me to stay away from Al-Anon. Wasn't nothing but a bunch of gossiping, cookie baking bitches is what they what they said. And I didn't know any different than to believe them. And then I started to go into conventions, and I started to taping. And I talked to myself a whole lot. David taught me that. He said, it's not Franklin that's causing you trouble, it's little Franklin. And said, you got to talk to him and push him down and tell him where he belongs. So I go around talking to myself a whole lot. I'm talking to little Franklin. And so I said, little Franklin, as long as you go into these things and tape it, you might as well tape the whole deal. And so I made the great decision to tape an Al-Anon speaker, and he knocked me on my butt. And I thought, my God, these people got the same program we got. And these people are sick. And some of them are sicker than us. And it ain't no difference in this thing. So I began to go. And about 7 years ago, my wife, she has over 19 years of sobriety in the program. And she came across and joined Al-Anon. She says to learn to live with me. And I believe her. And it's been the greatest change in our house that could have ever taken place. She had a 10-year-old daughter when we married, and that daughter is 29 now, and that daughter grew to hate me, and there was absolutely no communication. Eloise and I couldn't communicate. We could shout at each other and cuss, but we couldn't communicate. And by Eloise applying her Al-Anon program to her life, and then me starting over with my AA program and applying, our home has been changed into a house. And I call this little daughter of Eloise's my daughter. And she calls me her daddy. And this tie I have on, she gave it to me. It's got horses on it. I don't know whether that she's trying to tell me anything or not. But that little girl loves me today, and I love her. And I think Mickey and Eloise are the two best friends that I have. And it's all because of these programs. It can't be anything else. And I am just, my hat's off to Al-Anon. But lest you Al-Anons feel too smugly, you remember we damn drunks got you where you are today. And don't you forget it. I've forgotten where I was. I get too carried away when I get talking about Al-Anon and what the two programs have done to our lives. And I got out of the penal farm, as you can see. And as I say, after about 9 to 10 years, I got uncomfortable. And I went to David, and I said, David, by then, I didn't no longer had to read to him. He had learned to read. And we had become real close. And I loved David, even though at that time I hadn't told David I loved him. And he said, yes, I know. He said, I've been trying to approach you on this for some time. But said, you had a shell up there and you wouldn't let me get through. And said, I've been praying every day that God would let you come to me, that would let you become willing to come to me before you got drunk. And it's only by the grace of God during this time that I didn't get drunk. And he believed in going out on the lake. And I didn't know why he won't take me out on the lake all the time. I thought he was going to throw me in. But we went out on the lake and spent the day. And he said, there's nothing wrong with the program. It's in your application of the program. And said, I don't know whether you did some of it right the first time or not, because you wouldn't take the fifth step with me the first time. You took it with a professional. And I know why you did, because of some things that you didn't want to tell me. You didn't know that I already knew them. And said, I'm afraid that you didn't take the right kind of a fourth step. If you didn't take the right kind of a fourth step, how could you take the right kind of a fifth step? And said, there's nothing to do but start over. Says, you can accept that you are absolutely powerless, I think. I said, yes, I can. I can accept the whole part of the first step. Right now, 100%. I know that in the past that I have, I have taken things over. But I know it hadn't worked. And he says, I think that instead of having to accept the group as a higher power, that you can know, you no longer have any trouble calling it God. I said, that's right, David. He said, all right, your trouble, in my opinion, is from the fourth step on down. Now, why is it necessary to take a fourth step? The book tells us, but I think the best reason I can think of to take the fourth step is so you can take the fifth one. If you hadn't taken the fourth one, ain't no way to take the fifth one. And why do I need to take the fifth one? It's because the book tells me that those who do not take the fifth step invariably get drunk. Seldom do this, do we see it fail. It says we hadn't, on the next page, it says we hadn't learned enough of humility and honesty that is required of us by telling it all, and it has all in italics. Now, David told me so when something's in italics, it's important. Telling it all. We've got people in my group that say, I know somebody been sober 20 years and never have taken the fourth and fifth step. I said, I grant you that. I know a fellow that is sober 29 years and never did take it, but he got drunk. But let me tell you this. You ain't dead yet. And that person you talk about ain't dead. And if you want what this program has to offer, is what the book says, then these are the steps we took. And I said, I'm not going to take a chance on it, because I'm not really fighting now to stay sober. I'm trying to follow directions where I can get as much as I possibly can out of this program. And that's the reason I want to talk about this, is because I think that I'm on the right road now. And I know that I've made a lot of progress. And somebody that's been in this program without a drink for over 22 years, I think, should have made some progress. And I just thank God that my little old sponsor, David, was able to recognize this back there somewhere between 9 and 10 years. And that he kept himself spiritually fit where he could be of maximum service to God and the people about him. And he put his arms around me and walked with me and showed me the way. I think that's love in action, and I think that's what a sponsor is supposed. I think it's on page 72. If you want to check me out on that thing about the importance of taking the fifth step. Now he said, the first time you took the fourth step, I've got an idea. And I don't know how he knew how damn true he was. He said, I've got an idea you took an immoral inventory. Said, I think you put on, I went to bed with so-and-so such and such a time. I stole 50 cents such and such a time. And you didn't get on to the guts of this thing, what effect it had on you. says, do you know what a moral inventory is? I said, I think I do. He said, it's both good and bad. And says, to an inventory, you write it. And says, in the big book, it says write many times. And said, I know you wrote it because I saw part of it. You showed me part of it. But said, let's start over and really do this thing right. And you know, when we took the third step out there on that lake together, that's the first time after all the people I'd sponsored, after all the reading I had done to David, that's the first time I realized that there's a prayer in there before the third step. And David told me, he says, you're a real alcoholic. We're not supposed to tell people that, but you're a real alcoholic. And in the beginning, when the old timer said humbly, they meant on their knees. And says, let's get on our knees. And we got on our knees and I read that prayer in the third step. God, I offer myself to thee to do with me what thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them may bear witness to those that I might help of thy love and thy power and thy way of life. May I always do thy will. Now, that may not be exactly the same words, but it's not changed up enough to where it would alter what it is. And then David says, I'd like to hear you say that in your own words. And I think God would too. And I did it. I said it in my own words. I had my eyes closed, and David had his eyes closed. And when I finished, I looked up, and tears were running down David's cheek. Tears began to run down my cheek. And I embraced David, and for the first time in 10 years, I told that little ignorant, illiterate cuss that I loved him. And he told me he loved me. Now, where can you find anything any more beautiful than that? A great spiritual experience. Then he said, let's get on into the fourth step. And this is another thing I think a sponsor's supposed to do, is to explain those directions. He said, I want you to read to me in the fifth chapter the three areas, read on and find the three areas of your life that you're going to examine. And I read it, and the three areas of my life that I needed to examine, of what I got from the directions in the big book called Alcoholics Anonymous, was resentments, fears, and my sex life. And he said, let's turn back to page 65. And he said, I want you to look at that format there that tells you what to do. Put on who you resented, why you resented them, and then let's find out why. And right at the top, just before that, in the second paragraph in there, it tells something about security and those things as what were the cause of things that affected you. But said, I think for you it'll be simpler if we turn to the 12 and 12. And he turned to the 12 and 12, and on the first page in the fourth step in the 12 and 12, he had me to read that I had three God-given instincts. I had an instinct for sex, an instinct for emotional and material security, and I had an instinct for companionship. He says, now all people have these three instincts. They're God-given. So it is only when you misuse, or one of these is threatened, or one of these is misdirected, that you will have any trouble. He says, I think you're going to find that every bit of trouble you had was from a misdirected instinct. So I went back. See, he told me how to do all this, and then I went home, and I did it. So I went down my list and put everybody I resented, and I put why I resented them, and then I turned to these three basic instincts, and I saw which one of those instincts was affected. And then he told me, after you do this, says you look and see and dig and see what emotion was affected. And I saw on that format on page 65 that in every case, fear was a basic emotion that was affected. So after I did this, or after he told me about this, he said, now turn to the 12 and 12 and read me about the 7 deadly sins, because I was ready then to get into my fears. And he had me to read about pride, sloth, gluttony, all of these things. And he had me to read that it's no mistake that pride comes first. And he had me to read on further that any time the satisfaction of a basic instinct is my sole purpose in life, then pride steps in, and pride justifies this. Tells me, no, you're not getting enough of what you want. You deserve this. So then pride leads to a lot of other troubles. So when I'm doing this, according to the 12 and 12, it says I will eat more, I'll drink more, I'll lust for more of everything, never being able to get enough. Now what that tells a simple drunk like me is that every bit of everything that has caused me any trouble, the motivating force has been a basic desire to satisfy a human ego. To satisfy a human ego. And you dig in there and see that's not it. And when that ego is not satisfied, fear steps in. So there again the word fear comes. And I had a lot of fear. And I didn't recognize I had a lot. So he had me to list my fears, and I won't go through all of them. A fear of being caught, as I told you. Somebody seeing through. A fear of being rejected. A fear of not being accepted. A fear of failure. Therefore, I did nothing. I sat on my tail. Nobody could criticize me if I didn't do anything. They could criticize me for being lazy, but they couldn't criticize me for making a mistake. I had a fear of God. I had the wrong conception of God. I had a lot of guilt. And David says, you're a damn liar. You ain't got no guilt. Said, you're only sorry when you get caught. Said, you never were sorry before you got caught. Said, you can call it guilt, but said, that ain't what I call it. Then about sex. I don't remember much about sex, so I can't talk too much about it. But the book tells us a whole lot about sex. And it says, examine our motive. Have we been selfish? Of course, all of us know that if we're having sex with somebody else's wife, that ain't right. And I think we can go by our conscience in a lot of cases. And of course, we know what the Ten Commandments are. But I think it's misunderstood sex is with our mate. And I think if we're doing something selfish, Sam, if the mate don't feel good and we're trying to force them to sex, or if the mate is using us, sex, our sex, in order for them to get a coat or a car or something like that. So I think your motive is a thing. But the book tells us that we have to pray. See, I didn't know there's so much prayer in this thing. And I hadn't really realized that I can't do this thing myself. I've got to have help. And the help is going to come from God. And I didn't realize that God uses people. And I was getting my help through my little sponsor, David. Because God was using him as an instrument, because he had prepared himself to act as a channel for God's love to flow from him to me. And then David said, you go home. Now, after we went over the fifth step, we spent a whole day. I don't see how somebody can go somewhere and in 30 minutes take the fifth step. But we spent a whole day out on the lake, and I took my fifth step. And then at the end of it, David opened the book and had me to read. It says, now go home and get in a quiet place and review the first five steps and see if you've done them thoroughly. If you have them, well, go back. David said, if you haven't gotten all of your four steps, write it down, come back, and we'll finish it. If you have, now you are ready for steps 5 and 6. People wonder, when am I ready? Hell, the book tells us when we're ready. You're ready to take 5 after you take 4. You're ready to take 6 after you take 5. So he says, now we are ready for 5 and 6. And said, if you're not entirely ready, more praying. You pray for the willingness to become ready. And then when you get ready, and David told me, get on your knees. I got on my knees and I said, God, I am now willing that you take all of me, the good and the bad. Remove every single defect that stands in my way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. And may I always do thy will. And then the book tells me I'm ready for 8 and 9. David had me to read that he believed in me reading to him. Had me to read that I had made my grudge list in step 4. Now what I had to do was become willing to go to these people. And he had me to read that if I wasn't willing, to pray to God to give me the willingness. And I can honestly say that I've been to every place that I can. I can't make amends to my father because he's dead. He didn't die during my waste alcoholism. But David told me that your willingness is enough. And you're willing to if you could have. So that's all you can do. So continue to take a personal inventory, and when wrong, promptly admit it. Sometimes promptly can mean 10 days or 2 weeks from me. That's not the way it's supposed to be. But I'll tell you this, when old Franklin gets to hurting enough, he goes and gets rid of that, because you have shown me the directions, and by following those directions, I can get rid of these things. So sought through talking and listening. And I might say this, that the more I talk and listen, the more aware I become that God is. And that's real important to me, that God is. I tell Buck, somebody last night, I've been retired for about the last 14 months, something like that. I've had a good deal of time. And I've had time to reflect back on my life and the life of many of my friends that I have known. And I've seen this miraculous thing happen. And I get to thinking about where it comes from. And well, guess what it boils down to? I've got more gratitude. And I used to say it literally scares me. But scares me is not the right word. I'm awed. And I have come to realize there's no way in the world that I can ever get all of this thing. But there's a lot of it I can get if I follow directions. And I've come to believe, and I believe that to believe means to rely. In fact, David had me to look it up in the dictionary. And that's what it said. Come to rely. I've come to rely on the forgiveness of God for yesterday and the grace of God for tomorrow. That only leaves me today. And if I can get up and make a contract, make a decision, make a contract, I have a beautiful day. And I can do this most days. And the days that I don't do it, I have something to compare with, and I know what I need to do. And I want more of this thing. So as I said, I know I'm on the right road today. And I think I'm further along that road than I've ever been. And I know I can get a whole lot farther along that road, because I know I'll never run out of God. And that is a real comforting thing and something to be really, really grateful for. So having had a spiritual awakening, that word spiritual awakening scared the hell out of me in the beginning because it sounded churchy. David had me to read there's nothing but a personality change. So he said, don't you worry about it. You ain't got no damn personality. So having had a personality change as a result of these first 11 steps, I try to tote this message and practice these principles in all of my affairs, and the principles boil down to one, love. But carry this message. What is the message? The 12th step tells me it's purely and simply, and that is all, the message of a spiritual awakening as a result of the first 11 steps of this program. Joe McQueenie over here got a story he tells, and if I tell it one more time, it'll be mine. But I've given him credit for it up to this, but this is the last damn time. He said Paul Revere carried a real simple message. He just rode a horse through the neighborhood yelling the British are coming. He said he never did get on off his horse. I said he just shout that. He didn't get on off his horse and tell them, now, if I was you, I'd do this about my marital problem. I'd do this about my financial problem. And I'd do this about that. He just rode through the country saying the British are coming. I said them SBs knew what to do. They knew the whole ass. Now, he didn't say that. I had that. So I've got a simple message to carry and to practice love in all of my affairs. I told you what I think this deal is. I've been around long enough to see and experience the miraculous healing power of love. And I know that sober alcoholics radiate love. As I told you, the alcoholics in my group loved me sober. And I just hope that today I'm becoming addicted to that love rather than alcohol. And one darn thing for sure, I know more about this love today than I've ever known in my life. So I thank God for a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, for my God. And I thank an ignorant, stupid, illiterate little sponsor that had, according to what the big book says, prepared himself to be of maximum service to God and the people about him. And I want to close, as I always do, with my football story, which I think wraps up this thing. I think that my manager, God, is saying unto me this afternoon, Franklin, I'm going to get up a football team, and I want you to be the quarterback. And I'm going to give you three men in the backfield that you lost during your act of alcoholism, and I'm going to give them back to you in the reverse order in which you lost them. I'm going to give you hope, faith, and charity. And in the line, I'm going to give you seven powerful men that you were also introduced to in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you use these, they'll block out resentment, self-pity, intolerance, impatience. All of the stumbling blocks will cause you so much trouble during the first 45 years of your life. At the two ends, I'm going to give you honesty and humility. At the two tackles, tolerance and patience. At the two guards, unselfishness and gratitude. And at the center, willingness. Now, it'll be necessary that you use willingness on every play. Now, this game is going to last a lifetime. There'll be no timeout. So I'm going to have to give you some ground rules. And I'm not only your manager, but I'm your coach and the official, too. So I'm going to have to give you some ground rules. And these ground rules are the Ten Commandments. And the first four of these have to do with your relationship with your manager and your coach, God. And the last six have to do with your relationship with your teammates. Now, the ball is your eternal soul, and the goalposts are the gates of heaven. Now, get in there and play ball. Ladies and gentlemen, I need each and every one of you in my search for truth in this game of life. And I thank God for the people and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love every one of you. Thank you, and God bless you.